Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, August 22, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss voter ID laws. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We also welcome two experts for today's call. We'll hear in order opening remarks from each of about 8 to 10 minutes, then some discussion, and then, as always, questions from the audience. We're going to hear first from Professor Daniel P. Takagi. He's at the Moritz College of Law in the Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. He will be followed in opening remarks by Ms. Maya Narona, associate at Baker & Hostetler here in Washington, D.C. With that, Professor Takagi, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Dean. Let me start by thanking the Federalist Society for organizing this discussion. I've participated in many Federalist Society events over the years, and while I don't always agree with some of the perspectives that are offered, it's always an honor for me to engage in robust debate with an organization that is so devoted to the value of that principle. So, voter identification is a subject to which few people come without having both information and usually an opinion. It has been an extraordinarily contentious subject over the past decade or so, and it remains one today with several recent court decisions that have either struck down or at least partly modified voter identification laws as well as related restrictions on voting. So what I'm going to do in the few minutes that I have is three things. First, offer just a little bit of context regarding the ongoing debate regarding voter identification. Secondly, to talk about the three kinds of legal claims that we've seen in the recent litigation over voter ID and related restrictions. And thirdly, talk about some of the specific states that have been an issue and explain why, as a general matter, I think that the decisions either stopping or softening voter identification requirements were correctly decided. So first, as a matter of context, we've seen over the last 16 years a great deal of attention from both the major parties and from various other groups to the rules regarding voting, something that very few people were actually paying attention to before Florida and Bush versus Gore. Congress got into the act in 2002 by adopting the Help America Vote Act, which included a limited identification requirement applicable only to first-time voters. Since then, we've seen a number of states enact more stringent voter identification requirements, most notably requirements that people show government-issued photo identification in order to vote. Georgia and Indiana were the first movers on that front, and the Indiana law was upheld against a facial challenge back in 2008 in the Crawford versus Marion County decision, with no majority opinion, but a majority of justices applying basically a balancing test to the constitutional challenge alleging that this was a violation of the right to vote. Lawsuits over voter ID and other restrictions have continued in the years since Crawford, and those other restrictions include limitations on early voting, same-day registration, provisional voting, and restrictions on absentee voting as well. We've seen over these years some of them blocked, some of them upheld. And the last notable development over the last few years that I think is important for you all to be aware of is the Shelby County decision, which effectively stopped the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act from remaining in effect. In particular, it struck down the coverage formula on the ground that basically it was outdated. In the wake of that decision, we've seen some state and local jurisdictions move to adopt more stringent restrictions on voting. And that leads me to my next topic, the kinds of claims that we've seen in the last few years. So there are basically three. The first is the kind of claim that was at issue in Crawford, the Indiana case, which is alleging that voter ID or other voting restrictions imposes an unwarranted burden on voting. What the court has said is that if the burden is severe, then strict scrutiny applies. If it's a lesser burden, well, the state isn't necessarily off the hook, but it can generally justify those restrictions by showing that the restriction advances important government interests. The second kind of claim, which we've seen in a number of states recently, is a discriminatory intent claim made either under the 14th or 15th Amendments of the Constitution or under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. You all are probably familiar with intent-based claims, but they don't necessarily require a smoking gun showing intentional discrimination. In fact, nowadays, as opposed to 50 years ago, it is very rare to have someone admitting that they acted on an intentionally racist basis. And so these claims, like the undue burden type claims, they tend to be very fact intensive. The third kind of claim that you've seen in the recent litigation is a claim alleging a discriminatory result under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Section 2, unlike the Constitution, doesn't require a showing of intentional discrimination in order to prevail. Rather, it permits the plaintiff in a voting case to prevail if the result is discriminatory, although exactly what this means and how to apply it has been the subject of some disagreement and uncertainty over the years. The United States Supreme Court hasn't spoken on precisely what standard governs Section 2 claims made in the context of burdens on voting as opposed to vote dilution claims like redistricting. So moving to the specific cases, I think I've got about 2 minutes or so left. So I'm just going to run through these relatively quickly and explain why I think at least most of them are properly decided. The first case worth mentioning is one that comes out of North Carolina, North Carolina NAACP versus McCrory. This case involves a law that was adopted in 2013, very shortly after the Shelby decision. North Carolina was a state 40 of whose 100 counties were formerly covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. That means that those counties and the state, when it made statewide changes, were required to get preclearance. In the North Carolina case, the court, in a decision that just came out on July 29th of this year, concluded that the 2013 law, including its voter identification requirement, was motivated by intentional discrimination, and on that basis enjoined several provisions of that law, including not only the voter ID requirement, but its restrictions on early voting, same-day registration, and provisional voting. One of the issues that's arisen in this litigation is this question of whether it's race or party, which in these kinds of cases can be very difficult to disentangle, right? North Carolina, of course, has a Republican-dominated legislature. So the question that's arisen is, well, was the objective here to target Democrats, to target African Americans, who, of course, disproportionately vote Democratic, or was it something of both? And what the Fourth Circuit says in its opinion in this case, I think correctly, is that they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. In particular, in the state of North Carolina, whether or not someone is African American is a very good predictor of how they're going to vote, with back in 2012, roughly 95% of African Americans voting for the Democratic candidate. So it's not an either or, and in view of all of the evidence, including the history of discrimination in North Carolina, as well as the North Carolina is actually requesting, its legislature requesting information on how these various provisions would affect African American voters, that the requisite showing of discriminatory intent had been made. There's also been litigation in Texas, and I'm going to talk about the remaining cases very quickly because I know that my time is running short. In Texas, the challenge in Vesey versus Perry has been to a voter identification law. In that case, the court, the Fifth Circuit, actually found that there hadn't been an adequate finding of discriminatory intent, sending the case back on that ground, but that there was a showing of a discriminatory result in violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, given the disparate impact that the law would have on Latino voters, as well as various contextual factors. Other states worth mentioning: Wisconsin, whose voter identification law was upheld in an opinion by Judge Easterbrook back in 2014. Interestingly, Judge Posner, who had previously written the Seventh Circuit opinion upholding Indiana's law, would have taken that opinion en banc and actually wrote for the justices dissenting from the denial of rehearing en banc by a tie vote. More recently, there's been litigation over whether the identification requirements should, in effect, be softened, either by making it easier for voters to get ID or to allow voters to cast a ballot with a showing of a reasonable impediment. And there's an en banc petition pending before the Seventh Circuit, rather, right now on that question. North Dakota law was also invalidated under the Voting Rights Act under Section 2 on the ground that it would have a disparate and discriminatory effect on Native American voters who were less likely, substantially less likely to have the requisite ID than Caucasian voters. And finally, in my state of Ohio, we don't have a voter ID law, but there are a couple of cases that are going up right now concerning the rules regarding provisional and absentee voting, which have been enjoined by the district court, again, applying this sort of balancing test and finding that the benefits of these laws don't outweigh the harms that they would cause, and in particular the burden, in some cases a discriminatory burden on voters. Okay, so I probably run out of time at this point, but let me just say, I think the courts have in general done a pretty good job in these cases of applying the rather contextual test that the Supreme Court has given us, certainly for the discriminatory burden cases, as well as in trying to make sense of the Section 2 results test in the context of allegedly discriminatory burdens on the right to vote.
Thank you so much. With that, let's turn things over to Maya Narona.
Hi. Thanks so much for the Federal Society for hosting this debate and Professor Takagi for starting us up. I would like to talk first about Crawford a little bit to give some context. It was a 6-3 landmark opinion where the Supreme Court did uphold the Indiana voter ID law. And the recent cases on voter ID laws are attempts in many ways to readdress Crawford. But the fact remains that most of the litigation on voter ID actually has been lost by challengers because voter ID laws are facially neutral laws that do not discriminate. So as Professor Takagi talked about the Anderson-Calabrese balancing test that was addressed in Crawford, there are a variety of valid interests that the Supreme Court had recognized in that the state has in pursuing voter ID laws. First, there's the interest in promoting public confidence in the electoral process, particularly since public polling tends to show that there's widespread support for voter ID. So it's something that legislatures have seen as an important way of promoting the integrity of elections. So there's an interest in orderly administration of elections as well, As a practical matter, poll operators can recognize voters personally when it's a small town, but now since elections involve so many new voters and different voters that can't be recognized facially or by their name or face, it's something practical that election officials can do to verify voter identity. Also, there's the interest in deterrence, prevention, and assistance in the prosecution of voter fraud. And though the courts have typically talked about voter impersonation, voter ID laws do also deal with non-citizen voting, double voting, and fictitious voting. There was a great study from Jesse Rickman who did a study of non-citizen voting and found that it had a factor and could have changed the results of the elections in North Carolina and Minnesota in 2008. And there, in the North Carolina case, there were instances of voter impersonation. So the claims that a lot of opponents have that there isn't, that voter fraud is non-existent, are simply not true. The other argument that voter ID, in support of voter ID, is that voting fraud cancels out legitimate ballots, and the state has an interest in counting only eligible ballots. They also offer an opportunity for those who don't have ID to obtain them and find good use in a society that typically uses them. The Crawford Court specifically cited a bipartisan commission, the Carter-Baker Report, that advocated for the use of photo identification in elections. And as the report noted, photo identification cards are currently needed to board a plane, enter federal buildings, and cash a check. Voting is equally important, end quote. Georgia and Indiana's voter ID laws have been in place for many years and found valid by the courts, and they haven't tended to show the serious problems that voter ID opponents have claimed. And now with a lot of the recent laws have reasonable impediment exceptions and allow affidavit requirements like South Carolina and North Carolina. So those requirements allow almost any claims of disenfranchisement to for those voters to be able to vote. There's also the provisional ballot provisions in those laws, which allow a voter to present their ID and have their vote counted if they presented ID at a later date. States typically also offer IDs free of cost, so the claims that it's an unconstitutional poll tax don't seem to carry a lot of weight. And the states have been conducting voter education to inform voters of the need to have IDs. So there's a lot of effort from the state legislatures to ensure that these voter ID requirements are pursued with enough information to voters. Now, as Professor Takagi mentioned, the case in NAACP versus McCrory, the North Carolina decision, it rested on intent at the Fourth Circuit, but there was a 485-page opinion at the district court, which went very carefully through all of the evidence and found that the allegations of improper intent, improper discriminatory burden, and the testimony that was offered by challengers to the law did not carry as much weight. And because of the Fourth Circuit opinion relied on intent, any political party could just simply use the Constitution or Section 2 as a tool to strike down election reforms. So it becomes a partisan tool, the Constitution, which is not what we should be using such laws for. And Crawford... also, I want to note that it cautioned against a judge rewriting election codes. In a concurrence, Justice Scalia had written that detailed judicial supervision of the election process would flout the Constitution's express commitment of the task to the states. And I also like to end with Judge Edith Jones and her dissent in the Texas opinion. She asked, why would a racially biased legislature have provided for a cost-free election ID card to assist poor registered voters of all races who might not have driver's licenses? And I think the truth is here, as many of these judges have found, that voter IDs are constitutionally and legally permissible. And thank you. Thanks, Dean.
Well, thank you both. I want to get to the audience questions, so let me begin by opening the floor to questions. People can begin queuing up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or even both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to our callers, let me make a quick commercial announcement, as it were, about our lineup of Teleform calls later this week. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at the same number, we'll have a special Teleform call with former CIA and NSA Director General Michael Hayden. He'll be talking about all things national security, including cybersecurity, and his new book. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Wednesday at 3, our Teleform will be about religious freedom at religious colleges. And then Thursday at 2, we'll be discussing the constitutionality of the CFPB. Today, of course, it's all about voter ID laws and litigation. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Before we go to that, I want to give Professor Takagi just a minute to respond to anything he might have heard. And I have a quick question for you, Professor, and that's I'm interested in the distinction you drew between race and party.
Yeah.
So is it just fine for a legislature dominated by one party to pass a law that discriminates against the other party, provided it doesn't discriminate against minorities at the same time? And if that's the case, does that always cut in the direction then of a party that disproportionately represents minorities, the interests of minorities?
It's a great question. And so under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, as I mentioned earlier, there are two kinds of claims that one might make, and that we've actually seen made. One is an intent claim, which of course can also be made under the Constitution, and the other is a results claim. Now, if race really played no part in the legislature's thinking as it was adopting this bill, if it wasn't the purpose behind the law to exclude African Americans from voting, if it was only the purpose to make it more difficult, let's say, for Democrats to vote, right? Then it seems to me there wouldn't be a plausible discriminatory intent claim. There might, however, be a plausible discriminatory results claim. Moreover, this evidence that a law was designed to make it more difficult for Democrats, or for that matter, for Republicans to vote, right, depending on the context, this could come into play as a part of the balancing test that the court has adopted in the Crawford case for right to vote claims under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. And your question actually provides a great opportunity for me to come back to something that Maya said in her comments. She did a very nice job, I thought, of laying out the argument for voter identification laws and for the upholding of those laws. But what's important to remember here is that context matters, right? The court, at least six justices on the court in the Crawford case, applied a balancing test where we look at the evidence on both sides. We try to ascertain how great the burden is on voters, and on the other side, how strong the state's justifications are. And in terms of what we should look at in terms of measuring the burden, it seems to me that that includes not only how great the burden is on the individual voter from a particular law, but also how many people are affected, and is there some disparity, whether it's based on race or economic status or on party, in who is affected by that law. Now, the Supreme Court hasn't exactly said that, but it seems to me, going to your question, Dean, that the question of whether one party or the other is disparately affected by the law, as well as whether that was the intent, that's germane to the constitutional inquiry, even though the court doesn't exactly say that in the Crawford case. It doesn't seem to me it forecloses it either.
Very good. Maya and Roni, do you want to get in here, or should we resort to the audience at this point?
Well, I want to point out that there were a lot of amicus briefs filed in the Fourth Circuit case talking about the actual proper interpretation or application of Section 2. And in Section 2, it actually says equality of opportunity. And so there's a question whether the results test is being applied accurately as it was by the Fourth Circuit. So the equality of opportunity to participate in an election, it might be too far to apply causation. It's not just correlation of race and party, but also was it a motivating factor of the state legislature in passing these voter ID laws? And there has to be evidence to show of that for a Section 2 claim. Thank you.
Once again, we've got two questions pending. If you'd like to add yourself to the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I'm going to ask one follow-up question just so I can clear this up in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's directed to Professor Takagi. And that's about what I see as sort of a similar phenomenon. And the question is whether or not it's okay to, if the facts bear this out in my hypothetical, if it's okay to discriminate against non-minorities. So mm-hmm. looking at campaign finance laws, there's a state interest there in
yeah.
The appearance of corruption. To the extent you set limits on individuals and how much they can donate, does that discriminate? Certainly, I guess it discriminates against the wealthy, and Republicans in some states are, I don't know, accused or characterized as representing wealthy white families or wealthy white people. Is there a discrimination issue there under the law because they're disproportionately affected by individual donation mm-hmm. limits?
So it's another great question because, you know what, let me say at the outset, the court has traditionally put these cases in separate buckets, right? Cases regarding political donations and spending, which it puts into the First Amendment speech bucket, as opposed to voting issues, which at least for the most part, it's put under the 14th Amendment equal protection bucket with different standards applicable in each area. Now, the suggestion of your question is that maybe we should recognize that these things aren't actually so different. And in both contexts, I do think that one might be able to make a claim, applying the Anderson verdict standard, that a law is discriminatory in its effect or its purpose. That might not be enough to make a claim, but that could certainly be part of your factual showing with respect to economic status or political party or certainly race. Now, one of the things you were asking at the outset is, could whites make a claim under Section 2? And I think the answer is they certainly could if it were shown that a law was adopted with the intent of making it more difficult for white voters to vote under existing equal protection doctrine. They certainly could make such a claim. And, you know, we've seen a few of these claims, not a whole lot, but yeah, it certainly is conceivable that such a claim could be made and could prevail. There was one case down in Mississippi several years ago where the Justice Department actually got involved, and the details escape me, but I believe the lead defendant's name in that case was Ike Brown, if memory serves. So we don't often see claims of voting discrimination made by whites as opposed to minority voters, but certainly the legal door is open to them, and they occasionally are made.
Maya, Narona, anything on this point?
Yes, great. Professor Takagi mentioned the Ike Brown case, and we should certainly remember that if a law is racially discriminatory, it should be invalidated by the court, but the evidence doesn't really present that for voter ID laws.
My counter to that would be, it depends. My argument isn't that every single voter identification law on the books is either constitutional or unconstitutional, but rather that it's a contextual case, and the court should do what I think the courts I mentioned have been doing, which is to look very closely at the evidence of both burdens and benefits and weigh that evidence, as the court has suggested, at least six members of the court have suggested, should be done in the Crawford case, relying on the Anderson verdict standard.
We've got quite a few people on the line, three of them with questions. If you now would like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a full 30 minutes left. Now four questions. Let's take our first
one. Let's open it up, yeah.
Yes, my question is, why are voter ID laws evaluated almost exclusively in terms of whether they prevent voter impersonation fraud, which might be very rare? Because perhaps a bigger problem with voting is the poor state of the voter rolls. County officials often don't know when voters move or die, and county officials don't verify the people who registered or qualified to vote in that jurisdiction. So voter ID arguably might prevent other kinds of voting irregularities. Consider, for example, a college student who's in state A, but who's actually domiciled in state B and has a driver's license in state B. If he shows up to vote with a driver's license from state B, that's good evidence that he's not qualified to vote in state A. And there might be other examples too of people voting by absentee using an old address, whereas states are much more careful in the integrity of their state ID cards. You know, when you show up to the DMV, you have to have proof of your legal address. So why is the focus almost exclusively on voter impersonation fraud?
Well, that's an excellent point. As I mentioned in my remarks, you can also combat non-citizen voting, fictitious voting, if you have to present an ID showing that you had that name and you are represented visually on that document, then that presents an opportunity not only to prevent fraud from happening, but to combat it and have evidence of it in a court to deal with election fraud.
Yeah, I guess I'm a bit more skeptical of whether a photo identification requirement is a very good indication for a couple of reasons. First of all, with respect to citizenship, well, there are non-citizens who have driver's licenses, and of course a lot of citizens don't have them, so it's not a very good proxy for whether someone is or is not a citizen. Well, I suppose we could require a passport, which would be a better indicator, but there would be then a large number of people who don't have the requisite document. With respect to residency, it's a similar sort of problem. Most people who are citizens of a state and have a driver's license probably have a driver's license from that state, but of course there are recent movers who historically have extremely low rates of voter participation. People who've moved from one state to another but haven't yet gotten a new driver's license, they would be excluded from voting. And by the same token, there are people who have relocated from one state to another and I suppose might, on this argument, want to try to vote in their old state, even though they really should be voting in the new state to which they've relocated. So I guess my point would be voter identification is a pretty poor proxy for whether someone is either a resident of a state or a citizen. Now, you know, the reason why the focus is at least primarily on voter impersonation fraud is because that is the kind of fraud that a photo ID requirement would, at least in theory, prevent or make more difficult. The reason why that doesn't turn out to be such a strong argument is because you have fleetingly few cases documented in which people actually try to do that. I won't say it's absolutely unheard of, but it's extremely rare. And going back to the balancing test, the question becomes whether imposing a burden, and especially one that's going to disparately affect poor people and perhaps racial minorities, is justified by the evidence. And again, I'm not taking the position that every single voter identification law ever enacted is unconstitutional, but in general, the anti-fraud justifications that are given for these laws don't stand up to careful scrutiny, at least don't show very much of a problem.
We've got three questions pending now. Let's go to our next caller.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate Maya and Professor Takagi, your participation on the panel. I'm fresh from a trip to Alabama in which I went to the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum, and I have that picture of, you know, days of past, I hope only, and the restrictions put on people's voting from what I saw there. And I also have in my mind from one of more recent elections, factually based or not, allegations that in places like Cuyahoga County there were districts with over 100% participation in voting. And both of those examples, for different reasons, make my head hurt. So my threshold question for both of you, in particular since Maya, you stated that there is definitely voter fraud, the question for both of you is it material? And what is your basis for concluding, you know, in Maya's case that there is, and I don't know for Professor Takagi is whether what your conclusion is, but whether there is material amounts of voter fraud, and sort of conversely, is there any, and if so, is it material amounts of actions taken so that folks can't vote? And I guess, and I'm sorry for a number of questions, but the third related question is, and at this moment it's more, if not exclusively, from the left, and although it could be in some places from the right or in the future from the right, but from the left, what is it exactly they're really afraid of that in some places in the country, not like where I'm here in the metro D.C. area, but in some places that there are going to be burdens placed on folks by what otherwise it would appear to be neutral in its application, you know, a requirement to show some sort of government issue ID, or are they concerned about things like in certain city areas where typically there are more Democrats than Republicans, it's not so much that folks won't be able to vote because they won't have a card, and that they will have a card, but rather the lines will be longer because it takes incrementally another 10, 15, 20% to, you know, look at a card where otherwise they might not. I just don't fully get what the complaints are about unless it's more political for other purposes and not really a factual matter. Thanks for trying to stick with my convoluted set of questions here.
Who wants to go first there? Go ahead, Marlena.
Yeah, thanks for that question. The question of inflated voter rolls is a serious question. In the evidence brought before the court in the district opinion that Judge Schroeder decided in the McCrory case, he noted that a lot of the evidence brought forward doing statistical analysis of voting rolls and voter registrations to try to figure out how many people would have been prevented from voting or unable to come in is misleading because our records aren't that clear. It's hard to match them up and determine what is inflated if someone is registered in two places but only voting in one. Then the other question about voter fraud, the question is not whether it's widespread. It's actually just whether it can change the outcome of an election. So, you know, local elections in particular can be decided by just a few votes. So if you know, there's only three cases of voter impersonation, I've seen elections that have been decided by that small of a margin. And we should always be concerned if the person who actually got the most number of votes is not getting into office. The other point is that the Crawford Court was not so particular on the amount of fraud and whether it was sufficient enough, because they rested their opinion on whether it was enough to damage the perception of the election as being valid or not. So election integrity, as having public confidence in it, was enough of an interest to justify voter ID laws under their analysis.
Well, so let me just start with, I think what's a part of your question, which is what are these cases really about? What's driving them? And I think from the perspective of the groups that are challenging these laws, the ultimate concern is that by increasing the burden, or to put it in economic terms, the costs of voting in a way that is likely to have a disparate impact on certain groups, be they defined by economic status or party or race, we're going to see less of it from those people on whom that disproportionate burden is imposed, that it's going to change the shape of the electorate. And yeah, that too could influence the result of elections, although, you know, resting your case on that is rather difficult because, yeah, in a very tight election, even a small tweak of the voting rules, whether to make them more liberal or more stringent, could make a difference. But I would go back to the point. I think the court has basically gotten it right in articulating a balancing test, a form of cost-benefit analysis where we look at the burdens and look at the benefits. And, you know, as Maya's absolutely correct, the court, at least the lead opinion in the Crawford case, says that you can consider not only actual fraud, but also voter confidence in on the state's side of the ledger. But merely invoking voter confidence isn't enough to justify a restriction. And in fact, recent evidence, empirical research has shown that there doesn't appear to be any correlation between how strict a voter ID law is and the level of confidence that people have in the integrity of the voting system. But, you know, I certainly agree, at least as an abstract matter, that preventing fraud as well as promoting voter confidence are legitimate government objectives. But again, it's a balancing test, and the evidence of harm to voters and to particular groups of voters has been much stronger in the recent cases out of Wisconsin, Texas, and North Carolina than it was back in the Indiana case that the Supreme Court decided.
If I might follow up with one of the questions that I asked, the piece about Cuyahoga County did in one or another recent presidential elections, do you have thoughts on whether that which was described, that there were, you know, well over 100% participation from in various districts in voting, was accurate or not?
So I've never heard that allegation, and I'd want to read more before responding specifically, but I would be extremely surprised if it were in fact true. Now, you know, there is sometimes a problem with deadwood on the voting list. Under the National Voter Registration Act, there are means that a state or local jurisdiction can take to reduce that deadwood following a prescribed process under that federal law. And you know, you will occasionally see elections with where in states where late registration is allowed, where more people will vote on election day than were on the rolls some period of time before. But I'd want to hear more and read the actual evidence on which you're basing this claim regarding or what you heard about Cuyahoga County before responding in any particular way.
Okay, thank you.
We've got four questions pending, a little less than 20 minutes, so we will continue to roll through our audience questions. Thank you for all your questions. Go ahead, caller.
Hello. Thanks to both of the panel. I wanted to know what actually is the evidence of harm. Is it more about there's a disproportionate number of people of different races who don't have ID already, or is there evidence that, like, statements from the legislator that they knew that and they wanted, you know, they wanted to affect voting disproportionately, for either of the panelists?
Yeah, great question. Maybe I can take this one first, and Maya can add anything. So, what is the evidence of harm? Typically, in these cases, you do see both statistical evidence and evidence in the form of declarations or affidavits from individual voters about their experience. And for voter ID laws in particular, generally speaking, states are providing them free of charge, at least if they want to get them upheld. So the evidence usually has to do with the cost and difficulty of getting the documents that you need in order to get an identification card, such as a birth certificate, which typically one would have to pay for. And in addition to this evidence regarding the burden on individual voters, you would see estimates from experts typically about how many people are affected and what the demographics of the affected people are. So, for example, in the Texas case, the district court found that roughly 4.5% of registered voters lacked the requisite documents, and there was also copious evidence in that case regarding the demographics. And, you know, what you usually find is that Latinos and African Americans tend to be disproportionately affected. This surely has to do with lower socioeconomic status and the fact that because they're on the whole less likely to own a vehicle, they're also less likely to have a driver's license, which is the most common form of ID. You may also have effects in some cases affecting younger voters and certainly poor voters as well, who are generally less likely to have the requisite ID. So just to sum up, it is one, the impact on the individual voter, two, the number of people who are likely to be affected by the law, and three, the demographics of affected voters.
Maya Narano.
Well, I wanted to point out in the Indiana case what was the turning point for the court was that, or at least in Justice Kennedy's opinion, was that
Stevens, right?
I'm sorry, Stevens' opinion was that the challengers had brought forth no plaintiff that had actually been disenfranchised. One had been an out-of-state voter in another jurisdiction, so wasn't legally able to vote. The other voters would fall under an exception, or they just chose not to vote. So it really needs to be brought forward, the evidence, more so in a lot of the litigation, who are the actual individuals that are prevented from voting. And in the Crawford case, they didn't present that evidence, and that's why the court ruled that way.
Yeah, and I think that I totally agree with what Maya just said, and it's a really important point, right? The evidence that plaintiffs put forward of burdens on voters in Crawford, in the Indiana case, was extremely weak, and that's a big part of the reason why the decision in the Crawford case, which upheld the Indiana voter ID law, hasn't foreclosed, and in fact has left the door open for the kinds of claims we've seen in subsequent cases like those arising out of Wisconsin, Texas, and North Carolina, where plaintiffs' counsel have done a much better job than in the Indiana case of documenting the various burdens that the ID laws in question and the other restrictions on voting impose.
You seem to be answering more than just the question of that one caller. We've got just one question pending. Maya, were you going to say something else?
No, let's go to the next question.
Okay, I thought I cut you off there. Okay, let's take our next call.
Oh, hi. Assuming that the end goal is to ensure the integrity of our national elections, what do each of you recommend is the most constitutional and efficient kind of productive way to know that voter fraud is not occurring?
So I love this question, and I think it's a really important one, and if we had a functional political system in this country, we might actually be able to do something about it. I actually laid it out in an article I wrote in the Harvard Law and Policy Review a couple years ago. I think it would be great. To my mind, you know, there has been some value in this ongoing debate, which has now been going on for well over a decade over voter ID, but often I find that this debate often sheds more heat than light. It's been a consistent source of friction, and it winds up with even more people, I suspect, kind of throwing up their hands in frustration at both of the major parties. I think it would be great if Democrats and Republicans could come together on a piece of voting legislation that would set uniform voter identification requirements across the country, preempting more stringent laws as well as those that are more lenient for federal elections, and also take some steps to expand voter registration, which I think is actually, even though voter ID gets most of the press, if you want to talk about what's the practice that has the greatest impact on people either voting or not voting, it's really more voter registration than voter ID if you look at the empirical research on the whole. So I would love to see Republicans and Democrats get together on a bill that would give us, I wouldn't say total uniformity, but greater uniformity, so that people, and there are many of them, who move across state lines don't find themselves being subject to different registration and identification rules. And, you know, of course, it would be a compromise. It wouldn't be something that everybody is happy with, but I actually think it would be a useful thing. I'm not terribly confident that a grand election bargain of this kind would come together, but if Democrats and Republicans really do care about both enhancing integrity, promoting access, and also ultimately improving voter confidence, it would be a good idea, rather than fighting all the time, to try to come together on some compromise legislation.
Well, I have one thought as a good reform would be in terms of overseas and military voters. If you look at a recent poll was done and found that 70% or something of that margin of military voters don't actually think their vote is counted. There's delays, and sometimes the ballots don't come in time due to mailing delays. So ensuring that your vote counts for that particular population of voters is something that I think anybody can support. Another factor, which I don't think anybody has disputed, is the prevalence of absentee ballot fraud. And that's something state legislatures should work on dealing with reforms. I don't think that there should be some sort of national law. Constitutionally, elections should be done at the state level. So federalizing the elections is not something that I would support.
Well, let me just add, for congressional elections at least, Congress certainly does have the power under Article 1, Section 4 to regulate the time, place, and manner of elections, and the court confirmed a couple of years ago in the Arizona versus Intertribal County case that, or Intertribal Council case, that power under the Elections Clause is actually quite broad, and an opinion by Justice Scalia, no less.
Let me make another call for questions here. If you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. Let me fill in the gap here by asking what might be I don't know if it's a good question or a bad question, but I'm curious about the burden on the state here, and why there is such a burden, and maybe the simple answer is, well, this is the right to vote, and that's an important right. But so I'll weave a hypothetical here. If the government, let's say the Virginia, wanted to incentivize voting, they wanted to be the leader in voter turnout for the whole state, mm-hmm. and they said, we're going to give every person who shows up to vote $100 just for voting. But we obviously don't want to give Dean Reuter $100 for voting where he lives now and where he lived 6 years ago and never got off the rolls. And we don't want to give a $100 bill to a 16-year-old. So to get your $100, you need to bring photo ID of some kind.
Yeah.
Is that permissible?
It wouldn't be under federal law, under which that would be considered a payment in exchange for voting, and so would almost surely be illegal as a matter of federal law. But I suppose you would then ask, well, what if we got rid of that federal law? It does raise a really interesting question, which is whether incentives to vote
right.
should be evaluated in the same way from a constitutional standpoint as burdens on voting. And I guess, you know, I can't think of any cases, at least recent cases, in which this has come up, because generally speaking, what's been litigated in the states I mentioned earlier and various others over the last 10 years or so are restrictions on voting, right? Not laws that are designed to enhance participation. I guess I would answer that question by saying I think that under the balancing analysis that the court has articulated, we might not look quite as skeptically on enhancements as opposed to burdens with respect to the vote, precisely because, as you mentioned in your question, the right to vote is fundamental. That's why the state does have a burden of justification here. On the other hand, if we had incentives that were operating in a way that was somehow discriminatory with respect to race, socioeconomic status, or political party, well, then there might be reasons to be concerned and to strike down measures that actually may result in more people voting because they do so in a disparate way. But it's in, I want to emphasize that my response to your question is more along the lines of thinking out loud about the problem, which is an intriguing one.
Yeah, I mean, what if we change the $100 to that amount that the legislature determined to be what it costs the average person to get the required photo ID?
So, in other words, we've got a law that
it erases the burden. In other words, it covers bus.
Yeah, it raises the burden, but it also provides a benefit. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in a case like that one, right? If the state is saying, okay, this is what we estimate the cost, both in terms of underlying documents and of your time and effort to be on average of getting the documents. So, we're going to impose this requirement, but for those who don't have it, we're going to write you a check to compensate you for the burden. It would be an interesting question. I think the state could make a pretty strong argument in that kind of circumstance that it actually isn't, that the burden is less than it would be, let me put it that way, in the cases that we've seen, right? Because you're basically compensating people for the burden they're having to undergo to get ID.
Right. Maya Narona?
We do
have three questions pending, but go ahead.
Well, it's an interesting hypothetical. I think it's interesting because it does raise, it turns around on its head, because it seems like challenges to voting restrictions seem to only go against anti-fraud provisions. And then any reduction in early voting hours or whether you can vote out of precinct, like we're dealt with in the North Carolina case, can only go one direction. And so how can a legislature actually reduce early voting hours legitimately if there's a history of discrimination in the past? Or if the courts are fighting this, it would go in the opposite direction and allow voting changes in a different way. So it's a good question.
Yeah, and a variation on this, which perhaps presents a slightly more plausible hypothetical. Suppose we did manage to go to get the technology right on internet voting, right? Given the digital divide, we might expect that expansion of voting opportunities would disproportionately expand participation among those groups that are already the most likely to participate, including those of higher socioeconomic status. So is that a problem? It's a very interesting question.
We do have three questions pending now. I'm afraid we won't get to all of them, but let's at least take the next question.
This is Carolyn Parlato. I'm a member of the society. I am a little disturbed in that in all the discussions in the cases and in your discussions at the way they value a vote. You look at the big picture and you look at would somebody, have not been elected. But to me, a vote is a very valuable thing. And not only that, when a vote is cast by someone who's not entitled to, they are canceling out somebody else's vote. So they're essentially stealing a vote. Maybe it doesn't matter in the big picture, but I think that the importance of each vote doesn't ever seem to be a subject of conversation. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Before our experts get to those, let me open the floor to the next two questions, if we could. We'll have all three questions on the table then, and then you can make a final thought and respond to any or all of those questions you can.
Yes. One comment. The court seemed to find that voter fraud is extremely rare and there's no evidence of it, but yet here on Long Island we have routinely 300 dead voters voting in Nassau County. So I don't see why that piece of evidence never gets in there. And secondly, on discrimination, there's usually discrimination against the small parties like the Libertarian Party getting on the ballot.
Okay, and let's get to this final caller, and then we'll open it up to our experts, as it were.
My question is somewhat similar. Here in Florida, every time the news media goes out and cross-references, for instance, juror questionnaires against voting rolls or driver's licenses against voting rolls, it comes up with a substantial number of non-citizens who are actually voting. Is there an objection under the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, to cross-referencing voter rolls against the Department of Homeland Security's citizenship list? And if so, what is the day objection to that?
Okay, so thank you, callers, one and all. I'm going to ask Professor Takagi to go first, and we'll give the last word then to Maya Narona. The three questions on the table, and wrap up as you're answering any or all of these: the way to value a vote, evidence of voter fraud, discrimination against libertarians and other parties, and then the cross voter rolls. So,
yeah,
Professor Takagi,
I'm not going to be able to answer
right. Everything
that's been asked, but let me just start by agreeing with the premise of the first voter's question. Yeah, the right to vote is really an important thing. It's very valuable, and it's important that we, including our courts, take it very seriously. And that does, also to agree with the caller, include not only access to the ballot, but also the integrity of the voting process. And, you know, I don't think this is an area where simple bright line tests are possible. The right standard, at least from a constitutional standpoint, is the one that the court has adopted in the Crawford case. And going to the question about burdens on minor parties, it actually is the same standard that applies to burdens on minor parties' access to the ballot under the Anderson-Burdick line of cases, right? It's essentially a balancing test, and minor parties, you know, quite often, especially here in the Sixth Circuit, do win challenges to state ballot access rules. There have been multiple decisions here in Ohio, my own state, regarding this issue over the years. But I guess, you know, what I hope we will try to do in this area moving forward is actually to pay very close attention to what the facts and the evidence show on both the fraud/integrity side and the access side. And, you know, I mean, I'm not familiar with a specific example from Long Island that was mentioned earlier, but what I would say is that there's a lot of reporting and there are a lot of claims that are made about widespread voter fraud, sometimes based on these attempts to match, where the closer you look at the evidence, the less there is. I'm not saying that voter fraud is non-existent, but it is much less common than media reports would sometimes lead one to believe. So, of course, when it is documented, that kind of evidence is relevant in the decisions, but the right to vote and the right of access to the ballot is equally important.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I want to just raise another point about voter fraud, is that it's really difficult if you talk to prosecutors and election officials. It's very difficult to actually prosecute. So that may be part of the factor why people keep raising that it's not occurring. The public has a perception more so that it is occurring, and that's what's been justifying these state legislatures in passing these laws. And I'd just like to conclude with thanks for that comment about protecting the right to vote and ensuring that the eligible votes are counted, and that fraud shouldn't take away our votes, and we should be looking for that type of integrity every election. Thank you.
Thank you both. I'm tempted to ask a final question about whether or not a state interest in reducing the opportunity for fraud is sufficient to act here. I take it it's not, but
I'm curious as to why that's probably a good enough state interest in a lot of other circumstances. Maybe it comes down to the value of a vote and the fundamental right to vote. But having said that, thank you both for an excellent call. This was terrific here today. And thanks also to the very engaged audience. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleform conference call tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be talking with General Michael Hayden. He's the former CIA and NSA director, and he'll be talking about national security and cybersecurity. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.